You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you. I want to give you a few updates on the people who are in the film, and which I think you'll enjoy hearing about, Nair, Micah, Naomi, and the Coopers. And also, I'm going to show you just a couple of quick resources that we have on the website that are free that I think you'll be excited about. And then we'll open it up, and I want to hear what you have to think, talk about, or questions, or anything you want to address. So, first of all, I stay in close touch with everybody. I text with Micah like every other day, and phone calls, and Nair and Naomi and their family. So Micah is still at Syracuse, doing great. He's, you know, he got his certificate, so he's done taking classes, but he continues to co-teach, you know, undergraduate and graduate level university classes. He's got this same vibrant circle of friends, although ever evolving, like many of us. And he and Megan did break up, which may or may not surprise you. There was kind of different feelings around autonomy and what they wanted, you know, in terms of independence and autonomy from their parents. Megan's family, you know, some of it may be gender related, some of it just style. Megan's a very independent young woman. You know, she's in college, she's working, but her parents didn't feel comfortable with she and Mike having unsupervised time together. And Micah very much wanted to have unsupervised time together. So that became a tension, and they're still on good terms, but they broke up, but they're still friendly. And Micah does his own wonderful public speaking. He accepted an award on our behalf for TASH recently out in Oregon. So he's amazing. He was just in Hawaii showing the film last week. Micah's 33 now, I think. And yeah, they had a big conference in Hawaii, and I can't be everywhere, so you know, we have these great partners that are also showing the film. Nair, great story about Nair. So Nair has really been excited about this film. He's been co-presenting along with Micah, along with Naomi, along with Steve and the Coopers have been co-presenting with me around the country often. And Nair was in an event we did in New Hampshire where I live, and we had the opening and we did a big exhibit of his art. And the whole lobby was full of his original art for sale. And we had, you know, price listings and everything. And he sold out in about 10 minutes, everything. And walked out with like $2,000 in his pocket. Very happy. Kind of like that great smile you saw in the film. He had the same kind of smile. And he's now in his transition years in high school. So still like my son, getting support from the school district, but starting to take college classes. So he just finished a community college class on self-advocacy and is now taking an art class at Mass College for Art, starting in just a few weeks. So he and his family are amazing. I mean, you know, like all the families, but Nair's parents, I was just really moved by the interviews I did with them, and you never know what you're going to get when you meet the right subject. You don't necessarily know about their family and everybody else, and they were just incredible, all the families. Naomi's still working at and loving Empire, probably the most inclusive and welcoming work environment I've ever been in my life. You know, whether it's around, you know, sexual orientation or economics or ability or race and gender, whatever, you are welcome there. And Naomi feels that, and so she's really engaged and continuing to work. They had a tragedy recently where their father passed away from an illness, so they're now navigating life that was already challenging, you know, without dad. So that's been tough. But Steve is incredible. I mean, what an amazing man, you know, to really help that family navigate a lot and be there for Naomi. And that sense that he's very honest about of being torn, you know, of wanting to have his own very independent life, but not wanting to leave the family behind. And the Coopers have been incredible. We've been friends for about 10 years. And it wasn't until I started this about 5 years ago that I asked Chris and Marianne, would you be interested in being part of this? And they never took money. I mean, they just wanted to do this project because of their son, Jesse, and because of the shared belief in high expectations for people with disabilities. And we've done 5 or 6 different festivals together. And thankfully, Chris has now done like back-to-back-to-back films, and I caught him just before he got busy, so I was really appreciative. So let me just, if I get the AV folks to pull up the website really quickly, I just want to show you something. We may need to dim the light a little bit if you can. So just real quick, if we have a great resource library that's free to check out. At the very top there, you hit the resource button, hit resource library. And what we've done over the last 5 years, we've been collecting what we think are the absolute cutting-edge materials in the field. So if you click on resource type, let's click on inclusive education and hit apply, it'll scroll through all the materials we've been gathering from amazing specialists and families and individuals in the field. And you can just download PDFs or go to their website. We have employment, we have IQ testing, we've got about 10 different categories, assistive technology. So that's a great resource for you. Just check out the resource library, it's all free. And then if you click up to the home screen again, it's pretty cool, like the man behind the mirror is doing all this work. It's all technology, really. And then scroll down a little bit on the film. First, you'll see 4 buttons here if you keep scrolling. that will tell you where we're screening the film, about the film, keep going down, and the host of screening, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But if you click on Watch Our Four Free Transition Films, our lead funder on this project was Mitsubishi Electric America Foundation. It's a Mitsubishi is a big company. Their corporate mission is helping youth with disabilities transition from high school into college and career. It's all about transition. So part of the grant that we wrote for their support involved developing four free post-secondary transition films. You know, what does it look like to see a really effective practices to help students transition to adulthood? So the first one, I went out to Pine Ridge, South Dakota, and filmed at the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, a community with a median family income of $4,000 a year and a 90% unemployment rate. Unbelievable. So they are teaching kids how to start their own business, how to become entrepreneurs, and manage their own coffee shop, and think about ordering supplies and customer service. That's an 18-minute film that captures that and also gives you a sense of the Native American culture on the reservation. I did a film called Garrett Shows I'm in Charge about a high school student in New Hampshire who's leading his own IEP meetings, who's working, who's doing an internship in the gym class, included in regular education, great circle of friends, wonderful family engagement. Like if everything that you want it to be happening in transition was happening, it would look like Garrett's experience at a public high school. Scrolling down, I went down to Arkansas and did a film on an incredible national initiative to get students to have paid employment during high school. Students with disabilities have some paid employment during high school. A student with a disability that has paid employment during high school has a 75% chance of having paid employment as an adult. If you don't have that variable, you have a 25% chance of having. Yeah, so it's so critical to create employment opportunities, internships, apprenticeships for teenagers with disabilities. And then finally, Untapped is about Project Search. Many of you may know about that. It's a national program for transitioning students into employment. But it also, the middle of this film was filmed out in Arizona, where coincidentally my son goes to college. That worked out nicely to visit Isaiah. And it's about Medtronic, which is this huge medical manufacturing company, $60 billion company, and with about 60,000 employees, that has found that hiring more people with disabilities helps their bottom line, makes them a stronger company, makes them more effective, makes them more responsive to their customers, and there's a really great chunk of that film from the business perspective on the benefits of employing more people with disabilities. And finally, just if you can go back to the homepage, you'll see how to host a screening of the film. We've been making it possible for people to host screenings all over the country without me. So we've had a couple hundred screenings in the last couple months, either in movie theaters or through our education kit. So I won't go into detail, but if you want to host a screening of the film, you can. It's going to be broadcast. This is not like official yet, but it's close to official on public television nationally in October during this National Disability Employment Awareness Month. But in the meantime, we're showing it, you know, all over the country, both with me showing it, the crew showing it, and also people just who just want to have a screening in their community or their school or their university, and it's exciting. So there you go. So that's a quick little overview. I would love to talk about anything you want to talk about. Any questions, comments, thoughts, things you want to challenge me on, things you want to find out more about? Who wants to break the ice? Thank you.
From the time that you started until you completed the film, how many years was that?
You know, I filmed Nair. I started filming Nair. So the question was how long I've been filming. And if we need a mic, we can get that around. Maybe we should probably run the mic for accessibility. So I started filming Nair his freshman year and finished his senior year. So that gives you a sense. I filmed for about 3 years. I do all the filming myself, so I kind of can't be everywhere that I want to be. I hired a couple of people to shoot a couple scenes, but usually I like to do it myself. But Naomi was the last subject I found. I found Micah first because I knew Micah, and I just thought, what a paradigm shifter, right? This young man, vibrant life in college, doing all these great things, 40 IQ, which is considered, what, profoundly intellectually disabled. So I started with him, had the college story. I knew the Henderson School in Boston was already, I knew it was one of the most inclusive schools in the country. And so I knew the principal from a previous project. She introduced me to Nair. I was immediately captivated just by him, his artwork. The third story was tough. Naomi, I wanted to find someone in New England, near where I live, who was transitioning from a sheltered workshop into competitive integrated employment, who was a woman, because I had two guys already that I was filming, somebody with Down syndrome, because that's a really important part of the intellectual disability community. And I prefer my films to be very diverse, so if she was non-white, all the better. And that was hard to find, like all those variables. So I just did a lot of research, a lot of networking until I found her. So, and then I had a really incredible editor, James Rutenbeck, who also happens to have an adult son with autism, who uses a communication device to speak. And he spent about a year and a half, we did, working on the editing. So it's about a 3 to 4 year project. Yeah.
What I loved about the
Oh, yeah, we're going to use mics for the recording as well. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Wanda, and this is my first time coming to one of your meetings. But what I found touching to me is because so much is lost nowadays was the commitment by the siblings.
The commitment by who?
The siblings.
Oh, the siblings. Thank you. Yeah.
Brother and the sisters, mm-hmm. where the different patients, clients that you had.
Right.
Because, like, mostly the siblings have their own life. And so they put that to the side, and the parents just have to handle everything.
Yeah.
And some families, it's not both parents. It's just one parent. And so it's so much up on them. But for the siblings to take a part of the disability, that's what touched me mostly. Because I live in Brooklyn, and I deal with a lot of people, and I deal with a lot of disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
However, you don't see the siblings too much connected.
Right.
You see them doing this and that, and they don't want to take part of it.
Yeah.
So in your film, it showed the siblings put their life to the side,
mm-hmm.
special for the young lady.
For Naomi's brother Steve,
right,
yeah.
And the one that you know already, right. His sister,
yeah,
they all was very supportive. Everywhere they went, they was very supportive,
yeah.
And
yeah.
That's what touched my heart the most, because you don't see that nowadays. You just see separation,
right? No,
You get more separation,
sure.
Each day that go past.
I hear you.
To see the tightness,
yep,
that's was touching,
yeah,
because you got to see that now.
Thank you for bringing that up. I think really glad you brought that up. It's something that was kind of a surprise for me in doing the filming. I didn't pick the subjects because they had siblings that were so engaged, but it unfolded as I did the filming. And I just say a couple quick things about that. First of all, it shows you in some ways where the gaps are in our systems, that there isn't enough support in people's lives to have a full life without other people really stepping up, whether it's parents, which is the case in many, many cases, whether it's siblings or extended family or friends. And I so appreciate and admire, as you do, Steve and Emma particularly. At the same time, like in my own family with Isaiah, who's Samuel's older brother, Isaiah's 22, Samuel's 19, my wife and I decided early on we didn't want to put that expectation on him, because that's a lot to ask, and it could result in really negative consequences of resentment or him feeling limited or whatever it might be. He's incredibly close with Samuel. They really have a beautiful relationship. But I think each family needs to navigate that. And Steve and Emma have really stepped up. And I love what Emma says, you know, towards the end of the film. It just shows you don't know what people are going to do. I just love that line. I think it's such a prevailing theme for the film in some ways. So thank you so much for bringing that up. Yeah, so a hand right here. We'll get the mic to you. Oh, go ahead, you first, and then we'll come to you.
Thank you, really moving film.
Thank you.
And I
actually, it relates to sort of your introduction to the whole question, too. Just one.
We'll switch it out.
Hi. Hello.
Thank you.
Okay,
go ahead.
Great, thank you. Relating it to the whole question of diagnosis and essentially, I do know that African Americans are much more frequently diagnosed as in need of special ed, and I'm what I have not seen though is the sort of forensic work that has determined how much that's a consequence of African Americans being having a collection of sort of social issues, obviously, that sometimes have physiological manifestations like obesity, mm-hmm. whatever, or how much of it is actually through implicit bias. And I don't know whether mm-hmm. Any of that work you had a chance to, you know, how much your work might have reflected on that, or
right.
you, Ms. Lapham?
Yeah, and I'll invite Kate to talk about that as well. What I'll just say briefly is, first of all, there's nothing wrong with having a disability, right?
Sure.
I mean, sometimes, Samuel's very proud of his disability, of having cerebral palsy. There's a strong autism, you know, autistic self-advocacy network and other groups. So just having being diagnosed with a disability is not necessarily a bad thing.
Sure.
The problem is when that diagnosis or that label comes with a whole set of expectations and potentially segregation. That is the case in many, many, many schools in our society and internationally. I think in the case specifically around the high prevalence of low IQ scores being assigned to African Americans, it was so rampant that California has actually banned the use of IQ scores for African Americans because there was such a disproportionality. And I think what that really just has pointed to is the cultural bias around IQ testing. And yeah, I think the Coopers spoke it really well. We don't dust. We don't use dressers. You know, I didn't assign my paraplegic or quadriplegic child to dust the dressers. And I think no matter how much you try and quote unquote fix the test, it's still measuring just a certain set of pieces of your awareness. And it's not doing anything to measure your abilities, your contribution to the world, the social intelligence and emotional intelligence you saw with Micah, the artistic intelligence you see with Nair, the kinesthetic and social intelligence you see with Naomi. It does nothing to measure those things. But once you have that score, it sets up a whole set of low expectations. So I don't know, Kate, if you want to add anything to that. We'll get you the mic.
So I would also argue that even with that very narrow slice of intelligence that a very well-validated, rigorous test can measure, the best that you will possibly achieve is a snapshot of where a child is right now. It says absolutely nothing about where that child might be a week from now, a year from now, 5 years from now, even in terms of that very, very narrow academic subset of skills that a good intelligence test could measure, right? And so to assign an entire educational trajectory or a career trajectory based on that is just simply wrong for any child. It's not a useful form of measurement, I don't think.
And you end up making decisions about that child's placement, about that child's supports and opportunities based sometimes on that assessment. And some people might want to know, like, what's the one state that doesn't use it, right? We say 49 out of 50. Happens to be Iowa. And the reason that they don't rely on IQ testing to identify intellectual disability is because in Iowa, you don't need a category like intellectual disability, autism, other health impaired, in order to get all the services you need in school. It's the only state that has something called non-categorical service delivery. You don't need to be in a category to get the services. So there's no need to pressure people to take the IQ test, because in every other state, in order to get that label of intellectual disability, the IQ testing is one of the tools that is used to great detriment in some cases. Yeah.
A bit of realia. When I taught my first year after college, I taught in Harlem, and I found that when people expected low expectation, low return from students, they got low return. When I said, no, I'm not paying attention to the tests that you've given me, I'm going to expect the maximum from my students. And mm-hmm. I got a lot from my students who were, I was told universally, they're not gifted, they're not, you know, they don't have even average ability. But when I said, no, I'm expecting a lot from them, and I did get a lot. Also, this is an interesting thing. I teach election law now, and the ADA is very aggressive legally, so that they do insist upon the perquisites that they have come to expect since 1990 from mm-hmm. George H. Bush. Mm-hmm. And so that's very interesting, because we regard them as very, very important when we pay attention to election sites and venues and various accessibilities and so forth.
Yeah.
So they're quite aggressive now.
Yeah, the ADA was game-changing legislation. It did so much. And I'll just say quickly on your first point, thank you for the work you did and to have high expectations. And there's a hand right over here. But what I'll say is that when Samuel was first, you know, given in his elementary school, they wanted us to have an intellectual disability label because they thought he'd get more services. And my wife and I just thought, you know, this doesn't click with us. Like, I don't think he should have this label, and it feels kind of weird to us. But that shows you sometimes the pressure that the teachers and schools are also under. The only way they can leverage services is by adding on these labels. So I don't want to put this all blame on educators or even psychologists. Sometimes they're trying to just get the child more services. But that's not a system that is functioning the way it should. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, thank you so much for your film. It was so beautiful. And I loved the humor, as you mentioned in the beginning.
Thanks.
You, and the tender moments. Amazing film.
Thank you.
The history, too, at the beginning, I found myself thinking a lot about was, you know, why are we even measuring? Like, who wants to measure? What for? And I think, you know, it really struck me that Hitler cited the United States as being his inspiration for the eugenics movement, and that had to do with slavery, mm-hmm. that this whole testing thing originated in the need to somehow justify slavery on the basis of something that didn't exist. Mm-hmm. No justification exists. Hence, the U.S. perfected this false testing that somehow sorts people based on false things, and that Hitler found useful. That's
right.
That's really scary, but I think that's an important part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of why, from the beginning, since racism until today, test measuring is about capitalism. It's about profit, and it's about people want. It's about the rationing of resources to determine which horse are we going to bet on, because this society is a horse race. Mm-hmm. So they want to find the horse that's going to win in the horse race. Whereas most educators, myself included, I have extremely high expectations of my students. I'm an occupational therapist. It's the state that's very cynical about their abilities and wants to test them according to a certain measure. And I know why that is, because they want to know who to ration their resources to. And I think they know, the ruling class and the state as well, I think they know that their measures are imperfect, mm-hmm. and they aren't able to capture the most potentially profitable human beings among us. But as, you know, thank you, open society, let's imagine a society that isn't based around profit and capitalism, but is just based around all of us, as the beautiful mother in the film said, nurturing each other's strengths and mm-hmm. benefiting and mutually flourishing as a result of that. So thank you so much for your film.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for being so eloquent in your comments. And I like the way you're putting it in the larger societal context. I mean, I think that people often ask when I do the screenings, why are we still using IQ tests? And I think it is a structure that is built, and it is very firm in place, and it's really hard to take down structures in our society. It's really hard to change silos and change the way we do business. There's an efficiency of scale, which is probably, you know, a capitalistic kind of foundational thought, which is that, you know, it's easier to just test all these kids and say, these kids scored here, they're going to go here. These kids scored here, they're going to go here. And if anybody thinks this is a thing of the distant past, hopefully I kind of made the point in the film that it's not. But I'll give you a really recent example. My sister-in-law is a teacher in Florida, and she's like a master teacher. She's a wonderful education public teacher, and she's now a coach of teachers in all different school buildings. So this year, she started this new job, and the superintendent brought her around to the different buildings, and she was observing, and she saw one class where all the kids with disabilities were included in regular classes. She goes to the next building, and same ages, and all the kids in the same district are segregated. She said, why is this building this way, this building that? The superintendent said, the kids who are included had 56 or above on their IQ. The kids who are segregated had 55 or below. Mm-hmm. This was this fall. So this is happening, you know, all over the country. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Good.
My name is John. I'm talking too close to my... John, also known as JC in the music and film industry. First of all, it's a pleasure to meet you. There's a lot of films and a lot of stuff, a lot of documentaries that are made about a lot of different issues, a lot of controversial issues, a lot of movies that are full of violence and a lot of profanity and sex and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. And you know, to see that someone's coming out with a cause that's like this, you know, that to show the humanness in life and like people's struggles is, you know, I just want to commend you first of all for that.
Thank you.
And second of all, like, you know, like the young lady was saying back there, you know, about the sibling support in the movie, like, you know, it's very easy, like, for people to just, like, you know, say, I'm not going to use, like, stigmated names, but, you know, people say, like, you know, I have a disabled or whatever, the retarded person, you know, in the family, and just, like, excommunicate themselves from, but to show, like, the support, like, you know, that was just amazing, you know. Yeah.
Well, thanks.
That's it. That's all I wanted to say.
No, thank you for saying both those things. I mean, one thing I think that I feel so honored to be in the documentary film business is you get to take people into stories and into lives that they wouldn't necessarily experience otherwise. And I personally don't think you can totally embrace a vision or a pathway or an alternate vision of what's possible unless you see it, unless you experience it. I think it's really hard to just read it in a research paper or an article or hear someone just talking about it. So I love like the three-dimensional quality of film where you can take people in this room all together tonight and sit here and experience this together and then talk about it. So I really appreciate that. And you know, just I have to mention real quickly, because you talked about you're in the music business, another really important person who stepped up for this film was Modest Yah, who many of you may know his art, his music. And I got to know his mom, who lives here in New York, in New Rochelle, and she was head of the School Social Work Association. And one day when I was working on the film, she said, you know, maybe my son would be willing to be involved. He watched Including Samuel, he watched Who Cares About Kelsey, and he donated any music I wanted. He said, you can use it in the film. You know, he's a pretty well-known artist who just did that. And then every single other person who worked on the film, the writers, the musicians, all donated the rights. So I have to, you know, also call out people who have stepped up to help me do this in a way that it doesn't break the bank. So go ahead.
Thank you so much. This is wonderful. And I just kind of stumbled into this room based on finding out, like, through a mutual friend a couple days ago. So I'm really thankful for that.
Great.
And that made me wonder, in addition to screenings for the public, which I think are really important, are you also doing targeted screenings to school administrators and teachers, as well as with young people?
Yes and yes and yes.
Awesome.
Yeah, I am.
That's
I
so
actually,
great.
I'm traveling pretty much every week this whole school year. I'm going next week to Indianapolis for the Council for Exceptional Children conference, which I'm keynoting, and it's about 2,000 people. Actually, the conference is about 10,000 people, but it'll be about 2,000. And that's all educators around the country. And then I do a lot of events at schools. I do a lot of regional and national education conferences. And I've been doing that for about 10 years since my film, including Samuel, came out. It's actually a big part of how I keep making films is the budget. About a half to a third of the budget comes from these speaking fees that go back to my nonprofit at the Institute and help me with all of them. I have to raise all the money for all my films from scratch. So it's that's the challenging part, but most filmmakers have to do that. So
I feel you
yeah.
deeply. I do TV, yeah.
Okay.
So what is the response from young people? Do you have talkbacks with students, and how young does it go? Because there's some really heavy stuff in there, but kids are so... they know what's going on.
Right.
So what kind of responses do you get?
Sure. Thank you for that question. We got reviewed by Common Sense Media, which reviews media for kids, and they said 8 and up was their feeling that this film would be appropriate for. So that was good to hear. I mean, there's some tough institutional footage, you know, but there's no cursing. There's no, I mean, there's a little bit of talk of sexuality, but nothing too intense. So I have showed it mostly for some of my relatives and family members who are that age, 7, 8, 9. I've had it screenings, kids come. They've been totally engaged. I mean, I've had 8, 9-year-olds who just like tuned in the whole time. And then when I show it in middle and high schools, which I've done a fair amount of, I've been actually very happy and kind of stunned at the engagement. And I had people write me a lot saying, we just showed this for high school. You could have heard a pin drop the whole time. So I really, you know, I have two young, you know, boys myself, and I just really, really care about making films that are accessible to young people. I've always tried to do that. So it's always a filter that I run a lot of decisions through as I'm making films. Yeah. Thanks. We have two mics.
Yeah. Go ahead. It's just a
quick question.
Yeah. He's going to...
are there state laws...
You got it.
Are there state laws that, based on the numbers, on the testing, that prohibit people from getting driver's licenses and things like that due to a low score?
You know, in this country, I'm not aware of that. Are you? I don't think that specific metric is that opportunity is affected by IQ scores, as far as I know. But, you know, the death penalty is a big deal, which is a really interesting kind of side note. But I'll just tell you a little quick story. One group that really represents people with intellectual disabilities is the ARC of the United States. Used to have an acronym that meant something. You don't even want to, you know, use that anymore, but now they're just the ARC. They really love this film, and chapters around the country are showing it, but the ARC is writing an amicus brief, you know, in support of eliminating the death penalty for anyone with an IQ of 74 or below, which, of course, I'm not a big death penalty fan anyway, and so I certainly support the idea. It's it used to be the Association of Retarded Citizens, but now it's just the ARC. So anyway, the point I'm making is that they, even though they really liked this film, they actually felt like they had to draw back their like public support at the national level for it because they felt it would undermine their amicus brief, which is interesting, you know. And I'm kind of like, just look at all the messages in here. There's so much more than that. But what I'm finding is a lot of state and local chapters are showing the film anyway because even though the national is out. So I bring that up just to say that there's still some use of the IQ score that could maybe lead to a positive end, you know, keeping someone off death row. But it also continues to carry forward the stigma and the institutionalization, so to speak, of the IQ score. Yeah, go ahead.
Two questions. Number one, you seem to be focused on the United States, and I would imagine globally, the U.S. is about 5% of the world. So I would imagine the population of the world is probably equally distributed with issues like that. Mm-hmm. Have you looked about what is going on around the rest of the world? Because there could be a lot of interesting advancements, projects, experiments.
Well, I'm going to hand that one off to Kate because this is her area of work, but your second question.
The second question is, you're just on a great life journey. I mean, I just see your love and your passion. Do you have a 20-year goal for your
retirement?
No. But you're not going to retire because you love what you do. So you
are retired.
So do you have a specific, other than making more film? Do you have something that you're sort of you're learning and you're moving in a direction to achieve X?
Thank you for asking the question. I don't mean to be light of it at all. So I'm going to Kate will answer the first question, and let me just quickly answer your second question. First of all, you know. I really do want to find a way in my life to maximize my time with my family. And if I can do that and work at the same time, that's pretty awesome. So Samuel and I are actually embarking on our fourth feature-length film, which will be a combined co-directed, co-produced effort to kind of document his transition to adulthood. And right now what we're thinking about doing, it's all kind of a work in progress, is him interviewing people, amazing people with disabilities around the country, about their wisdom, their experiences, and then simultaneously kind of documenting his own journey. And I want the whole film to be the whole crew of the film to be people with disabilities. The music composers, the directors, the editors, post-production, like everything. You know, we're just gonna hire a lot of people with disabilities because, you know, you gotta practice what you preach. So, and I tend not to look much farther than that. I feel like every film brings me to the next project. I was on the presidential committee under Obama for 3 years for people with intellectual disabilities, and that was really interesting, going to Washington and working with an amazingly diverse group of people. We wrote policy recommendations to the president every year. And that was something I never could have anticipated doing, but it was a really cool offshoot. So I'm open to things like that happening as well. I'd love to do more international work to kind of set up Kate, but frankly, I can't travel for more than a couple of days for my family because Samuel, I'm the only one in the family that can physically support him when we don't have our support people there. He's just too big for my wife. So, that's just part of our life, part of our reality. Let me get Kate to answer your question.
I mean, in terms of the international context, I think what you've seen here in the United States is quite reflective of challenges that exist broadly throughout the world. Right? There are some education systems that are more inclusive, like Finland. There are some that are more segregated, like Belgium. But by and large, the issue of intelligence testing and the way that people with disabilities experience education systems are quite similar to some of the challenges that were laid out here, but also similar to the good examples, right? In every education system, there are advocates and there are champions, and there are fabulous teachers who do expect more from their students. Sadly, also the disproportionate representation of minorities in special education and being assessed with disabilities is also reflected abroad. People of Roma origin in Eastern Europe, people of Turkish origin in Germany, that also exists.
Yeah, thanks, Kate. And Richard had his hand up, unless there's somebody else with the mic. Oh, well, let's go to this young woman here, and then Richard. Yep.
Sure. Hi, thank you.
Hi.
My name is Mary Beth. Thank you so much for the film. It was touching.
Thanks.
I'm the oldest of 5 kids. My youngest sister has Down syndrome, and so the 4 of us are all very much advocates for her personally, but I'm not necessarily like an occupational therapist or a teacher, something that's directly involved in the advocacy industry, for lack of a better term. So I know there was the take action button on your website, but are there other things that you would suggest for people who want to maybe be more involved than we currently are?
Yeah, thank you for asking. There is a whole bunch of things on that section of the website. But what I'd say is, I mean, I honestly just feel like everyone has to find their entry point into this or any other issue you care about. So for instance, my son Isaiah is also a sibling. He's not necessarily talking about going into disability rights work or education. But he's got a very strong social justice framework. What you were saying earlier about capitalism was like echoing in my mind about Isaiah. He would have loved all that. He's studying cultural studies. He really just took a course on Black Marxism, and he's just really in that wonderful college moment where you're just the whole world is open. I think that whatever he chooses to do, if he becomes a professor, which he's talking about, he will have this disability rights lens, and he will apply it to so much of what he does. And just in your day-to-day interactions with people, it affects you, I'm sure. In the way that, I mean, whatever you do, I bet there's that lens. Some people will choose to make it part of their work. Some people can choose to volunteer for some of the organizations that we partner with, 30 different national organizations, and you might just find one that you want to volunteer with or donate to or, you know, whatever it might be. I just feel like everyone needs to figure out what fits into their own life. Because, I mean, all of us, I'm sure, are trying to do good in the world. My mantra is increase joy, decrease pain. Like, if you do that in your life, that's all that matters. Increase joy and decrease pain. And if you're doing that, it doesn't have to be in the disability framework, but I'm sure you're informed by your, you know, and a lot of people, too, siblings just have a level of empathy and a level of compassion that they wouldn't have had if they didn't have that sibling as well. And that can be applied to so many different aspects of your life, relationships, you know, everything. So, go ahead, Richard.
One quick comment, three quick questions.
Sure.
It was just lovely, strong work. And, you know, it went really deep without being intrusive. You know, it illuminated. And it went through a lot of dark places without getting dark. You know, it just kept moving you in a great direction. It was beautiful. So that was one. The three quick questions. One, how much film did you shoot for the time? Number two, you know, there were a lot of moments that I saw, and I wonder if you saw them too, where like when he's asking the girl, can I talk to you after college?
Yeah.
Where you didn't get an eye roll, but you got that, which is part of that difficult journey of the pseudo acceptance that exists in the world, which is the milestones on the way to get to it.
Sure.
And then the last question is, you've seen this so many times now. What are two of the three things, like when you've been watching it, where you saw something fresh that you didn't see before?
Oh my gosh, I've known Richard a long time and I knew you were gonna give me some challenging questions, interesting questions. So in terms of the film, you know, people ask that sometimes and I gotta just count it up someday. I could just estimate maybe 500 hours, you know, for an hour of footage, hour of film. You know, as you know, I come from a photojournalism background. You just don't know when things are gonna happen. I think the most powerful moment for me in making the film was when Nair suddenly, his arm just went up and he almost knocked out his art teacher. And that was like the one moment I got that I happened to be there for, where Nair is very potential to have, as many autistic people do have, you know, an erratic moment happened. And I wouldn't have caught it unless I was just rolling. So that's question number one. Uh-oh, now I'm gonna have to remember your three questions. Second question, remind me again.
When, like, he's in the
Subtle moments.
Yeah.
So I, first of all, I think you capture those moments sometimes when you don't even realize it. I mean, often you realize it, but you don't always. The editor, I had a great editor who would just be looking for those moments, because I think you have to show real life. You can't sugarcoat this. Like, I was a little concerned that people at times would feel like they were laughing at people and not with people in the film. Like when Micah goes on that awkward date, okay? How many of you have had awkward dates? Right? Come on, everybody has. You know, I mean, that's life and that's real. And so when you have that moment where the girl's like, yeah, sure, we can like hang out after college, you know, and she doesn't really mean it, that's totally real. And it does reflect something that's deeper. That is, it's harder sometimes for people like Micah to keep these relationships. There's this great moment that I thought I heard someone react to, because people don't always catch it. When Nair was at the computer and he's working on something, and there's a girl next to him and there's a teacher in the middle, and she's like, do you want to share it with so-and-so? It's like a Google document. And he looks at her, she looks at him, she's like, yes. And he goes, yes. I think you caught that, didn't you? And I was like, not many catch that, but I love that little moment. Third question, sorry.
What are one or two moments when you
One or two moments. You know, I mean, God, to be perfectly honest with you, literally, my editor and I decided on every frame of that movie over the course of a year. There's nothing in it that surprised me anymore.
Something that you realized, though, that you hadn't, like, oh my God, I never.
I think things move me in different ways when I watch it. I think, sometimes it is by the audience. It's sometimes by what you react to. That's why I love seeing with a live audience, because it's things that react to. I mean, there's sometimes a piece of a lyric of a song that strikes me. It's like, I never really made that connection that lyric goes with that. You know, today I was thinking about the fact that our whole campaign is called the Opening Doors Campaign. And here we are at the Open Society. You know, I'm really saying that because it's like this idea of opening. People with disabilities are not necessarily looking for special access, special privileges. We certainly don't love the word special education, many of us. We just want doors to be open and opportunities. And that really struck with me. And I guess one other quick thing is that each of these individuals are really cool people and they have really interesting families, but the structures around each of them is not just coincidental. You know, the fact that Naomi got that job was because she has very progressive job supports, and they were doing these job trials and trying to fit her strengths to the environment. The fact that Micah is in college didn't just happen. That happened because of the Think College Network, which is 300 universities in this country that now create pathways for people with disabilities to go to college. The fact that Nair is going to art school now is because his teacher had high expectations for him and would bring him around to do art exhibits and to like see other artists and go to the Museum of Modern Art in Boston and see all these amazing, or the Museum of Fine Art, and see these wonderful things. So that strikes me, I think, every time I watch it, like how intentional the structures are around them. So thank you, good questions.
That's actually related to my question. Working in a residential setting, advocating for adults with developmental disabilities, one of the things, probably the biggest thing that broke my heart was seeing older adults who had sort of been through the workshop years.
Right.
And now with the transition to competitive integrative employment, which is a wonderful thing, what's happening is a period where folks are being put in day programs.
Yeah.
And they're essentially being babysat all day when they used to have opportunities that they don't have now. So one of the things that I'm interested in hearing what you're learning about is how is this transition evolving? How is it coming along? Because it seems like, from my very small perspective that I have on the issue, that for the vast majority of adults in this situation, they're not getting those great opportunities.
Yeah.
And in fact, they're falling behind.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really good question and a tough one to answer. You know, but I'll just say what comes to me, which is that, you know, Rhode Island, that lawsuit that the Department of Justice, you know, waged against Rhode Island was a major precedent-setting national lawsuit. There was another one in Oregon that was similar. And there have certainly been some big growing pains to shutting down all those workshops. And if you saw in the very beginning of the film, you saw some people like doing beads, and they had, that was like, you know, recently that I was filming that. So there are still people in Rhode Island that they haven't found jobs for. But I think my kind of big picture lens on this, and it parallels, I think, a lot of other social justice movements, sometimes you have to do something pretty dramatic, whether it's the Americans with Disabilities Act or the Voting Rights Acts of the 1960s or marriage equality or whatever it might be, that's going to, at times, cause some blowback and cause some really bumpy things, but it forces you to create different structures. It forces you to break down some of these institutional barriers that have existed for so long that will not be broken down without this type of major kind of, you know, earthquake, because there's no reason for people to break them down. So I don't feel good about the fact that people that you work with or people that I've seen being kind of left out of that transition. I still think there's a way to have progressive supports and opportunities for them to have employment. And I think if somebody has been in a shelter workshop their whole life and then has a genuine opportunity to be working in a real job, getting real money alongside their peers in society, that's wonderful whether you're 25 like Naomi or 70. And I think it should happen no matter what age you are. But I'm not trying to be overly Pollyanna either. I think it's really difficult. I think there are going to be, unfortunately, some people that may not catch that wave. But I don't see a way to get to a future without that kind of transition. And states, it varies dramatically state by state. Some states still have many, many sheltered workshops. It's not like a federal law. Although Olmstead, which is you saw briefly in the film, that's basically the law that people are using to continue to push to close institutions, saying integration has to happen at every level of society, including employment. So anyway, we could probably talk a lot more about that, but those are a few quick thoughts. We'll spend maybe five more minutes or so and then wrap up. Yeah.
Hi, first, as everybody else has said, thank you so much for doing work that gives a voice to people who are often unheard, so thank you.
Thank you.
My question is somewhat related to the last one, is in this film or in other films that you've done, have you ever come across people that are not open to these ideas? Or maybe you've completely blown their minds and opened them up to this idea, or have maybe pushed back. And if you have come across people like that, how have you talked to them?
Sure.
About
are you talking about after the film's made or during the process or both?
Either way, while it's being made, at screenings,
right.
You know, the people whose
sure.
minds probably do need to be changed.
Yeah.
Have you come across people who have been very vocal or
yeah.
about
yeah.
like, not agreeing with you?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. The answer is yes. I mean, I've probably presented in front of 100,000 people or more at this point, and I definitely have had people who have pushed back hard. For this film in particular, well, first of all, let me back up for a second. Sometimes you get pushback just in the filming process. People just don't want to be open to this. You have to pick your subjects really carefully and find people who are really invested as partners in the process. And Nair's family, Micah's family, the Coopers, Naomi's family, and that happens through a lot of trust, through a lot of conversations. You know, I tell them from the beginning, if you ever want me to put down the camera, that is your prerogative. You know, I give them power in the process and say, you have the right to tell me to stop filming. And they rarely do, but they always know they have that power. And then I think if the people in their lives around them see them so invested in the process, they're less likely to create obstacles. I mean, people in Micah's circle and Nair's and Naomi's. And you also have to gain the trust of the powerful people within those institutions, the head of the Syracuse department that Mike is in, the principal of the high school, you know, the people that work with Naomi. And sometimes it's a lot of negotiation, a lot of phone calls, so there is that. And then when I've shown the films, yeah, I mean, there are people that really push back on inclusion in general. They just don't believe that it's the right path. And I will be happy to have that debate with them, and I can give them 30 years of research that's irrefutable, that people with disabilities, kids with disabilities who are included in regular education, there's three decades of research to say they will be likely to have better outcomes in every area: communication, employment, post-secondary education, you know, relationships. Doesn't mean you can't have those things, but it's going to be harder if they haven't had the experience of inclusion. This film in particular, you know, you might imagine psychologists are pushing back some in certain groups, although the National Association of School Psychologists was actually one of our funders for this project, because they wanted to see this discussion happen, a more critical lens on IQ testing. And knowing that IQ testing is often, even if it is, you know, delivered in the most authentic way, the results aren't being communicated well to families and to schools and teachers in a way that's helpful. The stigma of that number remains no matter how you explain things. You're always labeled with that number, and that forms in, expectations that are often too low. So, but I've had some other conversations with psychologists that feel very much kind of blamed by this or being attacked. And what I've come to say most recently to that is, listen, when something is the norm, my job is not to boost the norm. My job is not to like just boost up what is happening. It's to look critically at something that's happening and that's really problematic and get people to take a more critical look at it. You know, so I'm not going to apologize for taking a really critical look at something that really needs to change. So that's kind of my last card that I put out there. I'm like, I'm just not gonna, you know, I don't do filmmaking just because it's fun to make films, although it is. It's really like a social, you know, change type of, you know, approach to my work. So, last question. Okay, we've got one right here, and then I think we'll wrap it up for the night unless there's anybody else. And I'll hang out if people just want to talk casually afterwards.
Hi, it looked like Micah's sister was studying to be a teacher.
She is a teacher.
She is a teacher, so that was her classroom.
That was her
and
classroom.
It was an inclusive classroom.
It is a classroom in a school that includes kids with disabilities. They just don't do it very well.
Well, I was wondering about what her training was to do that and how your audience, in terms of, I work for a college of teacher preparation.
Right.
But how you get that segment to understand the way to differentiate instruction and to include children
sure.
with disabilities in the mainstream classroom,
yeah.
and how you deal with parents who think that that's not a model for their kids who haven't been identified as a student with disability.
Right. No, it's a great question. So first of all, as you may know or may not know, like almost all my work leading up to this has been looking, showing how inclusion works well, but doing it through like interesting stories like Sam, including Samuel and Who Cares About Kelsey. And I did a whole series of films for this SWIFT project to scale up inclusive education. So I do try and take chunks of that in all my other work to show what it can look like. And then I think even in this film, you saw Nair School. I mean, Nair School is doing things really wonderfully well. If you really break down those scenes and see what's happening, all the positive behavioral supports, all the peer, you know, relationships that are being forged, the high expectations, the access that all the kids have, like that's a pretty bold contrast to, I mean, people may or may not pick it up in Emma's situation, but Emma was in a classroom of, as she said, like 18 kids, probably five or six very challenging kids with IEPs, some that were undiagnosed, no support. She had like one paraprofessional, but there was really not a great integration of services. And she's well-trained, but I think sometimes teachers are just set up to fail. And I think that was the case in Emma's classroom. She just did not have enough support in the classroom and too many kids and too high. It was disproportionate. There were too many kids with disabilities. And disproportionality, which is a big issue, I think, in New York and elsewhere, is a real problem. If you've got, it's not an inclusive classroom in the truest sense if you've got 50% of the kids on IEPs. And I think a lot of classrooms, that's the case. So hopefully people can parse that a little bit when they see the film. So I think we should wrap it up. We're about where we said. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Kate and the BNF for all your work. I'll give you the last word, Kate.
I just want to close by thanking everyone for coming and thanking our events team for staying so late and for helping us with all of the tech and the microphone. So thank you very much. Have a lovely evening.